Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And today, leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top stories of the past week. Our lead story today, of course, talks about the massive fires engulfing the west coast of the United States. Over 3 million acres are burning pretty much out of control. We're witnessing forest fires of historic proportions, not seen in human history. And the question is, why? Why do we have these gigantic fires burning out of control in California and Oregon? Why? And then we'll say a few things about the coronavirus. The vaccine that is leading the charge is being developed at Oxford University, but tests were temporarily halted because one individual developed serious neurological problems. Since then, tests have resumed. But the question is that good news or bad news when a vaccination trial results in a serious side effect? And speaking about side effects, children are going back to school. Many parents believe that children, especially those under the age of 10, are pretty much immune to the virus, but that's not true. The latest results show that yes, children, even children as young as 1 year of age, can in fact spread the coronavirus even if they are asymptomatic. And so you have to think twice. And again, the numbers are small, but non-negligible, and scientists have been able to document the fact that children are not necessarily invulnerable to the virus. And also, talking about the weather, what was it like, the weather, during the time of the dinosaurs compared to now? Previously, it was thought to be impossible to recreate the atmosphere of the dinosaurs, but that's no longer true. There's a new way scientists have used to measure the temperature, the atmospheric content of the early atmosphere going all the way back to the time of the dinosaurs. And the question is, what have we learned from this incredible insight? Well, let's just jump right into the top stories of the past week. Our lead story today concerns the West Coast. You know, California used to be called the future. You want to see the future? Look at California. With bustling suburbs, easygoing lifestyle, massive freeways, and the freedom to travel anywhere you want. Well, there was a fly in the ointment. Yeah, we hit a speed bump. And that speed bump is, well, not earthquakes. It is giant forest fires on a scale not seen in recorded history. Right now, tens of thousands of people are being evacuated in Oregon. Evacuations may eventually reach 500,000 people. The smoke is so bad, it's clearly visible from outer space. It's a health hazard. It's worsening lung problems because the smoke is so thick and dense. And this is the worst in recorded history. But the question is, why? Why all of a sudden do we have this tinderbox called California, Oregon, the West Coast? Why is it that right now we have more area being burned than 26 times the area burned just last year? Overwhelming firefighters. Why? Well, you can point your finger at one main cause, but there are several secondary causes. The main cause is human activity and human development. So let's list the reason why we have this perfect storm of fire. First of all, overdevelopment. As the population, especially in California, surges, populations are spreading into forest areas. Why is that? Because, well, people are fleeing the pollution and the congestion of the cities, and forest areas can be cut down, generating tremendous profits for developers. And so that's the first reason why we have this problem. We are encroaching upon Mother Nature. Second of all, as we do so, there was failure to clear the excess brush and tinder. In fact, the policy of fire prevention has always been the opposite. Put out fires as soon as they're found. In other words, don't let nature take its course. Well, the result of that is that there's a lot of unnatural brush and tinder out there stored up over many a decade because minor forest fires were extinguished as soon as they formed. And what does that mean? That means more forest fires. Third, we also have the weather. It's been unusually dry this summer. The winters have been wet, giving ideal conditions for overgrowth. We have high winds that are feeding the forest fires and low humidity. All of that gives you a perfect storm for a forest fire. But then, on top of all that, we have global warming. Temperatures are rising. Summertime is, on average, about a week longer than normal. And that, of course, feeds into the forest fires. So what do we do about it? Well, first of all, we have to have new codes and regulations, especially as people leave the cities and move into the forest, clearing area of brush and tinder. Sometimes we have to let nature take its course. So we have to transition to a sustainable energy policy as we develop areas like California. And there's a realization that there are limits to human activity. We cannot simply conquer nature because at some point, nature bites back. And so we are bumping up against nature's forces. And it's something to realize as we contemplate the future of California and the West Coast. Will we take into account conservation measures? Will we have smart development rather than chaotic development causing us to accumulate excess brush and tinder? Well, we'll see. Also, here's the latest news about the coronavirus. Leading the charge for a vaccination is the vaccine being tested at Oxford University, 18,000 people. That's right, 18,000 people so far have been tested. Eventually, about 30,000 people will be tested, but the trials were temporarily halted. One individual came down with a serious neurological complication, and the doctors panicked and stopped the trials. However, after a week of investigating this individual, they finally decided that the person probably was not directly related to an side effect of the vaccination, so they resumed the trial. So what's the lesson here? Is it good news or bad news that the trial was halted and then restarted? Well, the consensus among scientists is that it was actually good news because it means that we're erring on the cautious side. Anytime someone develops a side effect, immediately we want to see whether the side effect is due to the vaccination or due to a pre-existing condition, for example. Now, Russia and China have been criticized for rushing in. They are already giving their people their version of the vaccination for the coronavirus. In Russia, we now realize that they've tested less than 100 individuals. That's right. Eventually, they want to test up to 40,000 individuals. But already, Putin's daughter, they say, has gotten vaccinated. But it means that some people think that the Russians are rushing the vaccine. Now, what about the United States? As we mentioned, in the United Kingdom, 18,000 people have already been tested for the Oxford vaccination. In the United States, we have two vaccines being tested. Each one will target 30,000 individuals in phase three. So by the time phase three trials are over, we could have, believe it or not, 90,000 people that have been tested for the vaccine. So when will it be available? That, of course, is the $64,000 question. Perhaps as early as November. Most people shake their heads and say, well, December, January. And of course, it's going to be quite chaotic as to who gets the vaccination first. Most people agree that medical workers, nurses, doctors, the people that put their lives on the front line to save all of us, they should be first in line to get vaccinated. Second, the most vulnerable. That means the elderly, people over 65, people with underlying conditions, because they represent overwhelmingly the largest number of people that have come down with the virus, especially, for example, people who suffer obesity, also lung problems, kidney problems, underlying conditions. Next, people in poor areas that are heavily impacted by the virus. But hey, it's politics, of course, because we are entering a political season, so we'll have to wait and see exactly what's going to happen as vaccinations become more popular. Now, we should also point out that children are going back to school. And of course, we all heard about what happens when teenagers and college students go back. They go back to their partying lifestyle. They think they live forever. Especially fraternities and sororities are being hit very hard because there's a misconception that young people are invulnerable. Now, it's true that the bulk of cases has concentrated with the elderly, but that doesn't mean that people of college age and younger are invulnerable to the virus. No, they now represent the fastest growing segment of the population that's been exposed to the virus. Now, the new result is that children, in fact, a child as young as 1 year of age, we now realize that they can spread the virus, especially to their parents, grandparents, caretakers. So this was kind of a shock. Scientists thought that, well, for the most part, the younger you are, the more invulnerable you are to the virus. But now we realize that, no, you can have children who are asymptomatic, who look perfectly normal, but can spread the virus to their home. So think about that. If you have a child in school, be sure that there's extra layers of protection, because that kid, independent of that kid's symptoms, that kid could come home and infect the entire family. So it is something to consider very seriously. Also, we should say something about global warming and what we know and don't know about the weather. You know, when we want to know the weather, we want to know the weather not just now, but thousands of years into the past. Well, it turns out that if you go to, let's say, Greenland and dig right into the ice core and extract the ice, you're basically getting ice from snows that fell tens of thousands of years ago. The record is, reliably, we can go back about 600,000 years into the past by drilling into the ice. But that's just a blip on the radar screen compared to the age of the Earth. The dinosaurs were wiped out about 65 million years ago. Well, now there's a new way to gauge the temperature of the past. Instead of simply drilling into the ice cover of Greenland, scientists realize that there's another way to reconstruct the atmosphere going back now tens of millions of years into the past. And this is by looking at the seashells left over by microscopic ancient organisms in the sea. When they die, they leave behind their hard shell. And tens of millions of years later, by digging into the ground, we can actually extract the shells that were laid down tens of millions of years ago. And we can easily go back to the age of the dinosaurs. In fact, on the web, you can actually see this diagram. It's an amazing diagram of the temperature in modern times versus the temperature that goes back millions of years. And what we find is rather interesting. First of all, when I was a child, I used to wonder, how come the dinosaurs got so big? And if you ever bring back a dinosaur, hypothetically, would it freeze to death? Would it survive? Will it flourish? Can a dinosaur even exist in today's weather? Well, we now know that the atmosphere was quite different going back 60 million years ago, just after the death of the dinosaurs. It was much hotter. The polar ice caps were much smaller as a consequence. Sea levels were much higher. Many of the familiar coastline features that we see and love were underwater during the time of the dinosaurs. It was much warmer. And we can even begin to estimate the oxygen and carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere. So why were the dinosaurs so big? That requires, first of all, a warmer environment. Because, of course, dinosaurs will cool off and you have to heat an enormous amount of flesh. So temperatures were probably warmer. Plus, oxygen levels were probably higher because you have to oxygenate your muscles so you don't suffocate because you have so much muscle mass that has to be fed. And it seems that these results from analyzing the weather tens of millions of years ago seem to confirm that. And that's probably the reason why the dinosaurs got so big. But what happened afterwards? Well, tens of millions of years later, we entered a cooling period. And in fact, the ice ages set in. And you can actually see the ice ages in the shells that were laid down now thousands of years ago. And we're now in an interglacial period. The last glaciation ended about 10,000 years ago, sending into motion what we call civilization. Because before that, we were nomads. Nomads scrounging, foraging for scraps of meat and food in the ice. So there were no cities, there were no villages, we were nomads. Nomads chasing after the deer and the buffalo in the ice. But then 10,000 years ago, something magical happened, and that is the ice melted. For reasons we don't quite understand, probably due to the spin of the Earth, the last glaciation ended 10,000 years ago, paving the way for civilization as we know it. So right now, we are between glaciations. In another 10,000 years, North America could be covered once again by a half a mile of ice. Another ice age. So we are between two ice ages. Then the question is, of course, what about now? What's so different about now? Well, we see that it was quite hot during the time of the dinosaurs. Then it began to cool down rapidly, especially during the ice ages. And then when you look at this tiny little blip called the interglacial period starting 10,000 years ago, we see that it got warmer. And now there's a spike, an anomalous spike happening just 100 years ago. So here we have this chart going back 60 million years into the past. And then with a microscope, you can look at the temperatures today and you see what the temperature is this year. And you see that there's a spike in temperature and a spike in carbon dioxide. And if you extend that spike now into the future, you can begin to rival the temperatures found at the time of the dinosaurs. So in other words, we are at a crucial period in the history of our planet. Apparently, human activity is causing this spike in temperature and carbon dioxide just within the last century or so, a time interval that is so tiny, you have to have a microscope to see it on this chart. And you begin to realize that we are entering a historic period. And what about entering the point of no return? Is there a point at which this curve simply keeps on rising and rising, and no matter what we do, it's inevitable? Well, no. But scientists believe that there are a series of points of no return. One point of no return, one of the first points of no return we're reaching now, and that is the fact that Greenland is beginning to thaw out, glaciers are receding, and it means that sea levels are going to begin to rise. So the thawing out of Greenland, scientists think that we are passing that point of no return right there. But we still have not passed the point of no return for all of civilization. So it doesn't mean that Boston or New York are going to be underwater anytime soon. But if you extract this curve into the end of the century, begin to realize that we very well could be heading into a new point of no return. A point of no return in which case our cities will be underwater. Take a look at Venice. Venice already has enormous problems with flooding. They have to have gigantic locks to try to manage the sea level. But of course, there's only so much you can do. It's like trying to sweep back the ocean. Take a look at New Orleans. Parts of New Orleans are below sea level. And what about the West Coast and the East Coast? Realize that about 50% of the U.S. population lives near the West Coast and the East Coast, meaning that any rise in temperature could cause a rise in sea level, causing large areas of the United States to be inundated. Now, again, we're not talking about things that are going to happen soon. Global warming is, first of all, an average effect, and second of all, a long-term effect. And that's why democracy is sometimes ill-equipped to deal with these kinds of problems. You see, democracies are great when you prepare for things like war, because the threat is immediate, is visible, you know what you have to do, you rally around the flag, you say to yourself, we can do it, we can do it. But something like global warming, the rise of sea level, the change in the Earth's climate is gradual. It affects the economy. It affects people's livelihood. Their jobs are dependent upon it. And so it means, of course, that there's going to be resistance and denial about the effects of global warming. Now, there's also some good news on this front, believe it or not. And first of all, the cost of renewable technology is dropping. And super batteries are slowly becoming a reality. Just remember that the real bottleneck in a solar age is not the solar cell at all. It's not the efficiency of the windmill. No, it's the battery. How do you get energy when the sun doesn't shine and the winds don't blow? That's the key problem. It's a problem of economics and a question of technology creating a super battery that can give us energy to smooth out the daily energy cycle. And this means that peak summer, peak winter consumption of electricity, those peak areas can be smoothed out with super batteries. And we should also say that the price and efficiency of batteries is increasing by 15% per year, meaning that, well, we don't really have the super battery yet, but there are a lot of people working on that problem. And as we get more efficient batteries, we become closer to the solar age. Not to mention the fact that in southern France, we have the ITER fusion reactor. This is the ace in the hole. We physicists like to say that every 20 years, we will have fusion power. Well, 20 years later, 20 years comes by and we still don't have fusion power. But this could be the real McCoy. The ITER fusion reactor in southern France, even though it keeps being delayed every few years, you can Google it. We are within sight now of the time when we can turn on that fusion reactor and create more energy than it consumes. This is still a wild card because we don't have operating fusion reactor, but the energy for fusion is seawater. That's right, ordinary seawater. The hydrogen from seawater can be used to energize our fusion plants. And it means that we don't have to worry about meltdowns. As soon as the reactor has a problem, it automatically shuts down. No nuclear waste to generate energy in a meltdown, and no nuclear waste to fill up nuclear waste dumps. The only waste from a fusion reactor is helium gas, which is actually commercially valuable, and you can resell it, and also radioactive steel, which of course is much less than the copious quantities of radioactive materials that come from a fission plant. But we'll keep you updated. And again, we don't have an operating fusion reactor, but keep your fingers crossed. We think that it could operate in the next few years by hitting break even. Well, that completes the first part of Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Well, we just discussed what the atmosphere of the Earth was like 60 million years ago, back to the end of the time of the dinosaurs. One day, we'll be able to reconstruct the atmosphere 3.5 billion years ago, when life apparently first started on the planet Earth. Perhaps at the bottom of the oceans, in a volcanic sea vent, or perhaps in a tidal pool on the surface of the Earth. Who knows where the first DNA got started? But then we have to ask the next question. We've discovered 4,000 planets orbiting other stars in our galaxy. How many of them have sustained conditions which make for life? Well, in the second half of Exploration, we're going to bring on Dr. Robert Hagen, author of the book Genesis, talking about a new science, exobiology, astrobiology, talking about the origin of life, not just on the Earth, but in outer space. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration, when we talk about life in the universe. Well, once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we talked about, well, life on Earth perhaps 60 million years ago, going back to the end of the days of the dinosaurs. And that begs the question, what was the Earth like 3.5 billion years ago, when the first life began perhaps at the bottom of the oceans, perhaps near a volcano vent on the bottom of the seas, or perhaps in a tidal pool near the coast. So the question is there life in outer space with the same conditions? We now realize that there are 4,000 planets going around other stars just in our little sector of the Milky Way galaxy. In fact, in the entire Milky Way galaxy, we think there are probably billions of planets, some of them Earth-like, some of them with liquid water oceans. And then the question is, can DNA or something like DNA get off the ground? Well, with us today is an astrobiologist, an expert in a field that didn't even exist years ago, to talk about life in the universe. He's Dr. Robert Hagen, author of the book Genesis. And so we're going to talk about not just life on the Earth, but what about life in outer space? One day, will we be able to visit these planets? Or for that matter, maybe an alien from one of these planets decides to visit us. Who knows? But today, we're going to talk about life throughout the universe with Dr. Robert Hagen, author of the book Genesis. The first question for you is, how did you first get interested in science as a youth?
Oh, man, I was so excited about nature when I was young. We had a house in Cleveland, Ohio that backed onto a swamp. And my brother and I would go tramping back, and we'd collect butterflies, and we'd collect frogs, and we'd collect crayfish. And at night, I loved looking up at the sky and the stars. And so my parents bought me a telescope, and the first one was really small, but then I got larger and larger telescopes and ended up building my own. So I loved looking at the sky, and Saturn was my favorite. So nature just turned me on. When I was in high school, I moved to northern New Jersey, and northern New Jersey is just a gold mine for minerals. They're famous mineral localities, and I had a teacher who pointed me in the direction and said, go to Franklin, New Jersey, go to Paterson, New Jersey, collecting minerals. And that's what really got me into mineralogy, which is my main field right through college.
Okay. Now, you are an expert in an area that is not familiar to the average person, and that is something called astrobiology.
So what is astrobiology?
Oh, astrobiology is one of the most amazing new integrated fields in science. It's the study of the origin of life, the distribution of life in the universe, and also discusses what the future of life might be in the universe. This is a field that has been brought to life by major new funding through NASA and the NASA Astrobiology Institute, which is based at the Ames Research Center in California.
Okay, so your book is entitled Genesis, The Scientific Quest for Life's Origin. Let's begin now in the year 1953 with an experiment done by a graduate student under the direction of his advisor by the name of Stanley Miller. Could you tell us a little bit about that experiment and how that led to a paradigm shift with regards to how we view Genesis?
Boy, Professor, what a transformation that was. Stanley Miller, young 23-year-old graduate student at the University of Chicago. His mentor was Harold Urey, who had won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of deuterium, the heavy hydrogen isotope of heavy water. So Urey was incredibly famous. Miller was unknown. Miller came to Urey and said, I want to try an experiment to make the molecules of life from nothing more than a primitive atmosphere. Now, Urey had proposed the primitive atmosphere consisted of hydrogen, methane, which is the natural gas you burn on your stove, and ammonia, that's the strong-smelling chemical from ammonia cleaners. And he mixed those together with water and just ran electric sparks through a piece of glassware. And lo and behold, in just 2 or 3 days, that clear, colorless solution began turning shades of pink and then brown, and then black gunk started getting deposited on the sides of the glassware. Miller had made a whole range of organic molecules that were basic building blocks of life. The amino acids that make our proteins, the sugars that make our carbohydrates, all sorts of molecules that form cell membranes called lipids. And not only that, a few of the bases that are called, these are the molecules that are key components of DNA and RNA. Many of the most fundamental building blocks of life just appeared out of a simple primitive atmosphere and sparks like lightning.
Okay, so let's back up a bit. What we're talking about is getting a flask with horrible chemicals like ammonia, methane, hydrogen, sending a spark through it, essentially replicating what they thought was the early atmosphere of the Earth bombarded by X-rays and lightning bolts and so on and so forth. And bingo, out of that came the building blocks of proteins, amino acids. So what was the reaction of the scientific community, which before that experiment was really basically had no theory as to how organic chemicals could form out of nothing?
It's true. This was a bombshell. The scientific community looked at this and said, wow, this must be how life originated. If in just a couple of days you can go from a simple atmosphere to all these building blocks of life, then given millions of years, the early ocean would just have been chock-a-block full of all kinds of organic molecules, and that was what led to this idea of the primordial soup, an early broth of just the right building blocks for life. So people thought, gee, it's just going to be a matter of 10 or 20 years, and we'll know everything there is to know about the origin of life. Of course, that was a little overly optimistic. It's taken us a lot longer, and we're still a long way from knowing. But this was the first experiment, the seminal experiment that set us on the path to believing that there is a chemical origin of life going from the simplicity of a geochemical world to the complexity of the biochemical world.
Okay, so back in the 50s, they thought that the early atmosphere of the Earth was a hostile brew of ammonia, methane, hydrogen, and things like that. However, today, we're not so sure.
That's right.
Today, many groups have proposed a different scenario for the formation of life on the Earth, very similar, of course, to what Miller and Urey had, but with a different chemical composition of the soup. What is now the leading theory as to what the atmosphere and the oceans look like back then?
Well, the one thing about the atmosphere is that Urey's idea of an atmosphere with hydrogen and methane is much to what's called reducing. We think that it was a much more chemically neutral atmosphere, including things like nitrogen, the dinitrogen gas that makes up most of our atmosphere today, perhaps some CO2, perhaps other minor components like carbon monoxide, maybe a little bit of methane, maybe some hydrogen, but not as chemically reactive as the atmosphere that Miller proposed. Nevertheless, when you put sparks through any of those atmospheres, you still get very interesting products. So the basic concept of the Miller-Urey experiment is certainly valid. But there are other environments, as you suggest.
Okay. Now, the Alvin submarine, which was used to probe the Titanic riding on the bottom of the ocean, and also to retrieve a hydrogen bomb dropped off the coast of Palomar, Spain, back in the 1950s, was also used to investigate what are called volcano vents. And some people say that perhaps volcano vents is where life got started. It's one theory, but could you elaborate on that theory?
Yeah, the idea here is that life requires a couple of simple ingredients. It requires water, some kind of water-rich environment. It requires energy of some kind. Now, Miller said lightning, other people say sunlight, but you also have the energy from the Earth's inner heat, and you require carbon and other carbon-based compounds, what are called organic molecules. Turns out one of the most exciting environments on Earth where all three of those ingredients come together are the deep ocean vents, the hydrothermal vents, or the black smokers, as they're sometimes called, on the bottom of the ocean. And these were discovered in the late 1970s by scientists diving in the submersible Alvin off the Pacific coast. Completely unexpected to find not just these hydrothermal vents, these undersea smokers, if you will, with all sorts of mineral-rich hot fluids coming out, but to find living communities far, far below the influence of the sun, where it's totally dark all the time, and yet life thrives because of all that energy coming out of the ocean floor.
Now, when we talk about energy, we realize that we mammals get our energy by eating plants. So we mammals could not have been the first form of life on the Earth. But plants, in turn, get their energy from sunlight in a very complicated process called photosynthesis, which also could not have been the original energy-generating device because it's very complicated. And we're talking about creating life from nothing, almost. So you're saying, essentially, that the energy supply could have been this very caustic environment on the bottom of the ocean?
That's the theory, and here's why people think that might be so. In our bodies, the energy, for example, from plants or from sunlight, is converted through a process called oxidation-reduction reactions. These are reactions just like that occur in a battery, your flashlight batteries. You're basically transferring electrons from one group of chemicals to another. And that exact same process occurs deep on the ocean floor because very what are called reducing fluids come out from the below the ocean surface, and they hit very oxidizing water in the ocean. And that couple, the oxidation and the reduction together, causes chemical reactions. Just like in a battery, just like in your body, that's what we think the very first energy for life was, just like a battery driven by the Earth.
Okay, now the astronomer Fred Hoyle had a different theory. In fact, he was quite the contrarian within cosmological circles. And he said the following: that the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, roughly speaking, and during the first billion years was the age of asteroids and meteors, constant bombardment by debris from outer space for about 1 billion years. We see that on the moon even today. And as a consequence, if life formed in the oceans would have boiled off, and therefore life could not have gotten started within the first 1 billion years. So after the age of meteors ends, boom, bingo, life gets started very soon. So he says this means that life could not have started on the Earth. It came from outer space in the form of spores. So he called this the panspermia theory. But what are your thoughts about the panspermia theory?
Well, at first glance, it sounds like a pretty crackpot idea, you know, life being seeded from outer space. But a lot of scientists are now taking this very seriously. I think there are two possibilities. One is that life is a cosmic imperative. It arises everywhere, and it arises very quickly. I've heard scientists say life comes about in 1 million years or 1,000 years. There's one very famous scientist in the field who even says it takes 2 weeks. Well, if that's true, then life would have arisen on Earth and there's no problem. But what if life does take hundreds of millions of years? We have a planetary neighbor, Mars, that was habitable long before Earth, much less in the way of bombardment by meteorites, much more benign in terms of its temperature early on. And it had oceans or lakes. We now know that from these recent discoveries by NASA. So Mars was habitable hundreds of millions of years before Earth. It's very possible that life arose on Mars. And then there's this amazing mechanism. If Mars gets hit by a modest-sized asteroid, say something that's 10 or 20 or 30 kilometers across, there will be, it's been shown, there'll be rocks thrown up into space. And those rocks will be relatively unheated, relatively unstressed. They could contain microbes. And those microbes could then be brought to Earth by Mars meteorites. So there are a whole group of scientists that are giving very serious consideration to the idea that all life on Earth is Mars life, because Mars was habitable earlier. And we may know that if in the next decade or two, when we go to Mars, when we look specifically for life, we may find Earth-like life or fossils of Earth-like life on Mars that represent our ancestors.
So if you want to see a Martian, you should simply look in a mirror.
That's possible.
Now, let me ask you a question that's bothered me for a long time. And that is, the Earth is roughly 4.5 billion years old, but there's only one DNA molecule, rearranged in different ways, of course, but there's only one DNA. It has ATCG as the building blocks, nucleic acids. That's why we can eat anything on the Earth. We can eat sea urchins, we can eat insects, we can eat plants, even though we're separated by a tremendous evolutionary distance, because we're all made out of the same molecule. Now, if the Earth is 4.5 billion years old and life gets started pretty quickly, then how come it didn't start again with another DNA and again and again? Why don't we see different DNAs? We only see ATCG. We only see a certain set of amino acids, and that's it. We've had now not just a few hundred million years, but we've had 3.5 billion years of quiet oceans with no meteor impacts to speak of. So why don't we have many DNAs?
Boy, Professor, you know, that's such a great question, and a lot of us are asking the question in this way. Is the chemistry that we see in life today inevitable, or are there lots of alternative pathways? Well, if there are alternative pathways, why don't we see them? And the explanation that's most often given is that life was a competition, and once that first successful self-replicating cell with all of its proteins and DNA, that very efficient, very powerful mechanism, once that cell got started, then it divided in a flash. You know, microbes can divide in less than an hour. So you had one, then two, then four, then eight. And in a matter of weeks, the whole Earth was populated by that extremely successful self-replicating cell. And that cell ate everything else. You didn't have a chance. If you weren't the first on the block to know how to live and know how to reproduce, then you were going to get eaten because you were food.
Well, let me ask you a question then. Food depends on proteins. Proteins, in turn, depend upon a template, that is DNA template, to create the protein. But there are many proteins that nature has not used. There are many proteins that you can create that nature has not even thought of. So why didn't another DNA get off the ground that was uneatable, inedible, that it was based on proteins that simply cannot be digested by our DNA? And it's not based on ATCG, the four nucleic acids, but it's based on a different set, PQRST or whatever. And it creates proteins that are undigestible by our cells, and therefore the two life forms should coexist. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think partly that life has been very careful in the molecules it selects. For example, RNA uses ribose. DNA uses deoxyribose. Why those particular sugars? These are sugars with five carbon atoms, and there are dozens of different sugars with five carbon atoms. Why those? Well, it turns out there's actually an advantage to those molecules because of their particular shape, and people have shown that if you try to use other molecules, they don't work. So to a certain extent, the molecules that life uses are the best molecules for the job. But also, I think life is incredibly good at taking various other potential molecules and eating them. It's just amazing how life has used all different kinds. Anything in its environment that has energy, life has learned to eat. And I think it's just once you get one kind of life established, it's really hard to get a second competitive system going. It's sort of like the ultimate monopoly. You can imagine some company makes the best car, the best computer, and other companies try to get started. But if that first company is so huge and so large, it just swallows up the competition, and nothing else to get going. Sort of like the diamond monopoly of De Beers. You know, there's never been another big company making diamonds because De Beers buys them all up and swallows up the competition.
Well, the reason I ask you this is because in science fiction movies, we always see aliens from outer space that want some very specific things. First of all, they want to eat us, meaning that they can digest our proteins, which I find remarkable. Second of all, they're going to want to mate with us, in which case they have basically the same DNA as us, literally, so they can interchange DNA sequences with us. And I find this rather impossible. But what you're saying is that in some sense, DNA really is preferable, and that maybe when aliens from outer space land on the Earth, they're going to have DNA which is very similar to ours. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's possible that some aspects of biochemistry will be very, very similar, maybe even DNA and RNA. But I think there will be very important differences. For one thing, we have what's called the genetic code, and that basically are sets of three genetic letters that match up to different amino acids, the building blocks of protein. I think that code may be wildly different there is a code on other worlds, that it would be very different from ours. So I can't imagine there being that kind of unity. So there's some chance events, some chance chemical events in the origin of life. But I think there are also some aspects of origins that are going to be very similar from world to world.
Okay. Well, if you say that, if another DNA got off the ground and our DNA basically ate up that DNA, then what happens when alien DNA reaches the Earth? Will our DNA consume molecule for molecule their DNA, or vice versa? Perhaps their DNA will consume ours.
Well, that's a real good question. It depends on the building block molecules. I can imagine alien DNA. I can imagine alien proteins that are totally poisonous to us and vice versa. It's also very possible that life on other worlds started with an opposite handedness. There is a very curious characteristic of life on Earth that all of the sugar molecules used in DNA and RNA are called right-handed. All the amino acids used in proteins are what are called left-handed. So there are mirror image molecules that our bodies can't use. In fact, that's one for dieting. There's a new product out. You can buy left-handed sugars, which taste sweet, but the body can't digest them. So this is one kind of artificial sweetener which gives you no calories. It's a great invention. It's a great idea. So if there were an alien life form that happened to be reversed, and they used left-handed sugars and right-handed amino acids, then they couldn't eat us, we couldn't eat them. I think we'd probably get along.
Okay. Now let's get back to the Miller experiment, because there's a huge gap that we left unfilled. Miller showed that amino acids, in some sense, are for free. We see them in nebulas in outer space. We see them in the cores of meteors from outer space. Amino acids are out there in outer space. However, DNA is extremely complicated. If you look at a DNA molecule, you say to yourself, oh my God, look at that thing. And it would have taken an awful long time for Miller to get a DNA molecule off the ground. If he had done his experiment for maybe a billion years in that little test tube, then maybe he would have gotten one DNA molecule off the ground. So there's missing steps now. So some people say that before DNA, there was RNA. And before RNA, there was even more primitive structures even before RNA. So what do we know about the gap between the amino acids that are for free that we see in the Miller experiment and RNA and DNA?
This is probably the single biggest uncertainty in question, but there's so many great ideas out there. For one thing, as you say, RNA is a very complicated molecule. It's hard to imagine how it was synthesized from scratch in a prebiotic soup. Mineral surfaces may have helped. There are some minerals that attract ribose. There are some minerals that attract the bases. But there are other neat ideas out there. In the book, Genesis, I describe an experiment by a person at our laboratory, a guy named Nick Platts, who realized that you could build up an RNA-like molecule from very, very simple building blocks. Little cyclical molecules, the kinds of things that are produced when diesel exhaust burns or when you have a sooty fire, that soot itself, if you put it in water under just the right circumstances, will form tiny little stacks of molecules. And those stacks, if they're in just the right environment, will attract the bases, the four letters A, T, C, and G of DNA. And those bases can line up on top of each other, and you can actually make a RNA-like molecule from scratch on the primitive Earth. Now, it's very possible, I think, that this is the sort of intermediate step where you build something that's simple from simple building blocks, and that mimics what's going to become more and more complex. You add layers of complexity gradual, one step at a time. So Nick Plath's idea is very, very powerful, and it's now being studied experimentally. That's the kind of thing people look for. You go from simplicity to complexity through a process known as emergence.
Now, if you go back, way back into the past, and what do we know about the most primitive DNA or RNA on the Earth?
Oh, Professor, that's a wonderful question because it has to do with what are essentially the most primitive biochemical features. What are the chemical fossils that we find in modern life that point to the earliest life? And I think the conclusion is unambiguous. There are a few chemical pathways that are buried in every single living thing. One of those is RNA. The ability for RNA not only to store information and pass it on from one generation to the next, but also for RNA to improve or catalyze certain reactions. Another is a cycle of what is known as metabolism, that is taking energy and atoms from the surrounding and building up new molecules. There's something called the citric acid cycle that seems to be built into every living thing. And there are a few other chemical pathways, the ability to take nitrogen and convert it to ammonia, for example. That's also fundamental. That's a way of using the element nitrogen in biological systems. So there are a few chemical pathways that we find in every living thing, and those we believe are the most primitive chemical pathways that point us to something about the earliest life.
And where are these organisms that are the most ancient, most primitive forms of life on the Earth? Are they in the bottom of the ocean?
Right now, the most primitive organisms that we know of are all in very extreme environments, in places where the acidity is very high, in places where it's very cold, in hot, deep hydrothermal vents. And people have two ideas about that. One is the possible, very real possibility that life originated in one of these extreme environments. The other possibility is that life originated near the surface, like Stanley Miller would say, but because of those nasty asteroids and meteors and comets that kept blasting the surface, the only life that survived those last insults was life that had adapted to the deep, hot, protected environments within the Earth's crust. So either way, those are the most primitive organisms that we see today.
Well, that concludes our interview with Dr. Robert Hagen. He's a professor of astrobiology, author of the book Genesis. And you know, years ago, there was no such term as astrobiology. Talking about life forms in outer space, you were considered a crackpot or a flying saucer buff if you were interested in alien life on other planets. But now that we've discovered 4,000 of these planets circulating around other stars in the galaxy, we begin to realize that life could be plentiful, at least microbial life. And then we begin to appreciate life on the Earth, where we have intelligent life. So many conditions have to be met to create intelligent life on the planet Earth. You have to have a liquid water ocean. You have to have a stable climate. You have to have a large moon to prevent the Earth from tumbling. You have to have a large Jupiter to clean out the early solar system like a vacuum cleaner of dangerous debris and asteroids and meteors which can destroy life. So many conditions have to be met, and yet, here we are. We are an example of a life form that did become intelligent, at least we think so, on the planet Earth. Well, that's it for exploration, and if you want to know more about exploration and my work, go to my website, mkaku.org, mkaku.org. I've written 4 New York Times bestsellers, and we have 4 million fans on Facebook. So join us every week when we discuss science and its impact on your life and mine. However, I'd like to add one last comment. When we talk about life in outer space, of course, the average person says, how come they don't visit us? If there are planets teeming with alien life, how come they don't land on the White House lawn announcing their existence, giving us the benefit of their technology? Well, most of my friends who are physicists would say that the distance between stars is so great that it would take thousands of years for flying saucers to land on the Earth. But, well, that assumes that they're only maybe 100 years ahead of us. Assume for the moment that they are millions of years ahead of us. New laws of physics begin to open up at that point, and maybe it's a hop, skip, and a jump for them to go across stellar distances with wormholes or different kinds of superliminal velocity rockets. And then the question is, then how come they don't visit us? Well, look at it this way. If they're that advanced that they can go across stars to visit us, then we are like forest animals to them. When you're in a forest, do you go down and talk to the squirrels? Well, maybe you do. But after a while, you get kind of bored because the squirrels don't talk back to you. You lose interest, you get bored. And maybe that's the reason why the aliens, if they're that advanced and they can go across thousands of light years to visit us, maybe, just maybe, we have nothing to offer them. Therefore, we think we're so great, we are arrogant to assume that they're going to go across the galaxy just to visit us, to give us the benefit of their high technology. I think more than likely they may simply laugh and observe us rather than interact with us directly. Think about the next time you meet a squirrel.